This is Tertul Aya. Before we start, what's on the table this week?
I brought the erosion of trust. Several pieces this week made the same case, that the real danger of these tools isn't the cheating everyone panics about. It's a slow decay of institutional trust and of the student's own capacity to think. One writer called it a bomb planted under critical thinking. I think that's the story, hiding behind all the others.
Mare, what did you bring?
The mental health cost of enforcement. There's a whole cluster of coverage. One Spanish piece calls it flagxiety, about students living under detection regimes, being flagged, doubting themselves, and what that does to them psychologically. I'm less interested in whether the tools work than in what the fear of them is doing to 18-year-olds.
That thread and mine are the same wound seen from two ends. The institution loses trust in the student loses trust in themselves.
Mine sits right between yours, then. I brought the false positive accusation crisis. Students wrongly accused because a detector decided their prose looked synthetic. There are lawsuits now. It's a due process problem dressed up as a technical one, and the reliability numbers underneath it don't hold.
Andres.
I went further from the campus. Data colonialism, the hidden human labor underneath these systems. The people labeling data for almost nothing, the surveillance sold into African conflict zones. There's a whole extractive economy we don't see from inside a classroom, and this week finally named it out loud.
That one kept surfacing in my reading too, and it's the one that most deserves a budget line rather than a headline.
Four strong pitches, and the editors overruled every one of them.
Every one?
Every one. This week's topic is equity gaps in AI adoption and policy. Who gets the tools, in what language, with what access, and who writes the rules for all of it?
I brought a lawsuit and lost to a category heading. Cordially, impressive.
Though I'll admit mine folds neatly inside it. Data colonialism is an equity gap that simply refused to stay in its lane.
And flagxiety is an equity gap too, once you notice which students get flagged more often. Fine, I'm actually interested. Go on.
Here's why it won. The phrase digital divide is old enough to have grandchildren. It was coined for telephone lines, inherited by broadband, and handed down almost unchanged to artificial intelligence. What troubles me is how fluent we've become at naming the gap by gender, by language, by region, by disability, and how little that fluency has moved the thing it names. 3 years of precise description, and I can't point to a single named gap that actually closed. We've built something, but I'm not sure it's a bridge.
It might be a very good map of the water.
That's exactly the worry. Finish the frame for me. I'll cut myself off there. You're listening to Tertulia, the AI conversation slowed down. This week we're sitting with equity in artificial intelligence. Not the version that trends, but the quieter question underneath it. Whether all the careful naming of who's left out has produced anything a teacher, a student, or a ministry can actually use. Priya finished my sentence a moment ago, so let her start us. What did you mean by the map?
I meant that the discourse has gotten extraordinarily good at cartography and hasn't yet built a road. If you read across the last year, the equity writing can locate the divide with the precision the broadband era never managed. It can tell you the gap is largest for students in a low-resource language, or for a student whose disability the interface never anticipated. What it can't tell you is who paid to close any of it, because as far as I can find, nobody has.
Saul, you've watched this vocabulary arrive before. Is this new, or is it the same worry wearing a new coat?
It's the same structural worry, and a genuinely finer instrument, which is an unusual combination. The structure is ancient. Some people get the new tool, some are left holding the old one. What's new is the resolution. In the broadband years, we argued about counties and countries. Now the literature can name the divide at the level of a single learner in a single classroom, and it does it in the future tense as a research agenda, while the systems are already being installed in the present tense. That gap between the tense of the study and the tense of the deployment is the thing I can't stop looking at.
Andres, you live inside the present tense of it. When this reaches an actual ministry, what does the equity conversation sound like on the ground?
It sounds like a promise to democratize access, repeated with real sincerity by people who have not asked who pays for the democratizing. And here is the part that surprised me when I looked at the numbers. the access framing is almost backwards. These tools reached over a billion users in 3 years, and nearly 70% of them are in developing countries. My students have the app. What they don't have is the infrastructure, the model trained on their language, or a single cent of the capital. The users are in the south, and the value pools in the north.
I want to slow that down, because it's the most important thing said so far, and it's easy to wave past. If the poor aren't locked out of access, if they're the majority of users, then access was never the operative variable. Which means most of the equity discourse has been optimizing the wrong noun.
Say more about that, because I think you're right and I want to hear you make it hard.
The whole opportunity register, extend access, add a language, coordinate a region, assumes the gap is a distribution problem. Hand out the tool and the gap narrows. But Andres just described a billion new hands holding the tool while the money flows the other direction. So distribution happened, and the divide didn't close. That's not a gap you fix downstream by shipping more of the product. That's a gap that lives upstream in who owns the thing you're distributing.
Which is precisely the point a group of researchers in Brussels pressed early in the year, and it's older than this week. Bias, they argued, is not a bug in a neutral system awaiting a patch. It's the sediment of historical data and existing power, learned faithfully by a machine doing exactly what it was built to do. If that's right, then the exclusion is upstream of the algorithm, and no downstream fairness patch ever reaches it.
Let me zoom out for 1 second, because I want the listener to hold the shape of this. We have a diagnosis everyone in the room seems to share. The gap is real, and it's not mainly about access. Where I want to spend the hour is the part that isn't shared. What closing it would actually cost, and why nobody seems to be paying. But first, Priya, is the diagnosis really shared? Is there anyone still selling the frictionless version?
Selling it, less than a year ago, the striking thing about the arc is that the optimistic pieces and the alarmed pieces were, for a whole season, the same sentence. The gap is real. The gap is closable. Closing it is a matter of will. That was written as good news. It took until about the third quarter of last year for the sentence to break, for the critical pieces to start outnumbering the cheerful ones. The consensus is recent, and it's thin.
Thin how?
Thin in that everyone now agrees to say divergence without flinching, which is real progress. A field that was still selling democratization in 2023 learned to say the gap might widen. But agreement on the diagnosis has bought almost nothing on the cure. We converged on the noun and stalled on the verb.
Let's put the arc on the table properly, because I think the shift Priya just described has a shape worth tracing, so I'll take us back to the top of it. Where does this conversation actually start?
It starts in opportunity. Early last year, the framing was almost entirely upside. A Wharton scholar wrote about AI exclusion as human potential wasted, a resource left on the table rather than a risk to be managed. The World Economic Forum put out a blueprint that treated AI maturity as a journey with unequal starting points but a shared destination, reachable through regional cooperation. That's the grammar of the seizable opportunity. The gap is real, the gap is closable, and the whole thing turns on will and coordination.
And I'd flag what that grammar quietly assumes. Coordination is a word institutions use when they'd rather not say budget. A shared destination reachable through cooperation is a very comfortable thing to write if you're one of the two blocks with the resources to cooperate. It flatters the people already in the room.
That's fair, and I'd temper it slightly. Some of that opportunity writing came from the South and meant it, from people who genuinely see a path and are trying to hold the door open. The blueprint isn't cynical everywhere. But you're right that the frame does the same work regardless of intent. It locates the solution in extending what already exists, rather than in changing who built it.
So opportunity is the opening register. When does the answer come?
Almost immediately, and this is where the Brussels work matters. Their argument, carried under a headline about unmasking inequality, refused the premise the opportunity discourse depended on. If bias is a technical flaw, you optimize it away. If bias is a power relation encoded in the data, you have to contest it, and contesting costs something optimizing never does. That distinction determines what kind of solution the problem even admits.
And it connects to a longer lineage that predates this whole cycle. The people who founded the AI Now Institute back in 2017 did it precisely to study these systems as a matter of social power rather than engineering hygiene. So the insight Saul is crediting to this year is really being rediscovered, the argument that AI is a mirror of existing power, not a neutral machine, has been sitting on the shelf for the better part of a decade.
Rediscovered is generous. I'd say re-forgotten and re-remembered on a cycle, which is its own equity problem. The field keeps having to relearn what its critics already established, and the relearning always arrives after the deployment.
Mir, you were nodding at rediscovered, but not entirely.
Not entirely, no. And here's where Priya and I see the arc differently. Priya reads the Brussels moment as the field finally catching up to the critics. I read it as the field absorbing the critics, vocabulary without absorbing their demand. You can say bias is structural power and still write a policy that tunes a model. Because saying the deeper thing costs you nothing if your recommendations stay downstream. I've watched fields launder radical diagnoses into modest fixes for 20 years.
I don't think we actually disagree on what happened. I think we disagree on whether to call it progress. You see co-optation. I see a vocabulary shift that at least makes the co-optation visible. A field that can say the word divergence can be held to it later. A field that only says democratize can't be.
That's a real difference between us, and I don't want to paper it over. I'll grant that naming a thing makes it accountable, in principle. I just don't believe the naming has been cached, and I'd rather we not congratulate the map for being detailed.
I'm going to let that one stand unresolved, because I think it's genuinely two readings of the same fact, and the hour won't settle it. Andres, take us into the middle of the arc, the quarter where the vocabulary hardened.
The middle is where one word takes over divide, and where the mood tilts, though unevenly. AUN projection warned that AI could affect 40% of jobs and widen inequality between nations. Coverage of workplace adoption found a new gender gap opening, not in access to the tool, but in willingness to use it, which is a subtler and harder thing to fix. And yet these were still labeled optimistic pieces. The alarm and the optimism were, for a season, the same breath.
And then the descent you both mentioned, the moment it comes down from nations to the classroom.
Yes, and for me that's the most consequential move in the whole arc. An Auburn study stopped asking whether AI would widen inequality between countries and started asking whether a personalized learning engine would tailor itself to every student or only to the ones the training data already understood. That is the exact question I bring to every ministry meeting. Does the tutor serve the child in the margin, or does it serve the child the data already knew?
And notice when that question arrives. It arrives last and funded least. The discourse achieved its finest resolution. Language equity, disability, the individual learner, at precisely the moment those subjects had the least leverage over what was being built for them. The map got most detailed exactly where the people on it had the least say.
This publication has its own thread through here. We've been circling this since spring.
We have, and I'd name the delta honestly, rather than pretend we nailed it early. Our briefings back in June were still repeating the democratized access claim, more or less on its own terms. By the September briefing, we were reading that same democratization rhetoric against its own results, a spectrum that ran from enhancing equity to entrenching bias, and we'd stopped taking the enhancement for granted. So even in our own coverage, you can watch the sentence break. We were not ahead of the curve, we were on it.
I appreciate that you said we were on it rather than ahead of it. That's the honest version. The dishonest version is the one where every publication claims it saw the whole thing coming.
There's a structural piece underneath all this rhetoric, though the regulation numbers. Saul, they seem to say the state is catching up.
They seem to, and the legibility is deceptive. The count is striking. AI-related regulation in the United States went from a single measure in 2016 to 25 by 2023, and the European Union reached agreement on its Landmark Act in the same window. Read one way, the state is finally catching up to the equity problem. Read another, the state is catching up only where the state was already strong. The regulatory action concentrated on both sides of the Atlantic, which is exactly where the resources to regulate already sit.
And this is the sentence I would underline for every reader in my region. The rules multiplied fastest in the jurisdictions least likely to be on the losing end of the divide. The students the discourse learned to worry about by the end of the year are disproportionately not in those jurisdictions. So you get a policy vocabulary that is globally uniform and an enforcement, a funding, and a benefit that stays sharply local.
and that uniformity itself is suspicious. When you look across national AI ethics policies, they're remarkably similar despite enormous cultural differences, which sounds like consensus and might just be copying. The same principles circulating between the same well-resourced capitals, photocopied and reheaded. Uniform rhetoric is not distributed capacity.
Can we come back to the pipeline point, though? Because I think it's the one that most resists the downstream fix, and I don't want it buried under the policy numbers. Saul?
The pipelines are the quiet catastrophe. Every surveyed European country reports more male than female graduates in computing at every level. Bachelor's, master's, doctoral. In the United States, the proportion of Hispanic computer science graduates grew, but modestly, a few percentage points. These are the pipelines that produce the people who build the systems, and they remain skewed at the source. The exclusion is upstream of the code, before a line of it is written. There's a line I keep returning to, that the tech industry has an ongoing tendency toward exclusion, and no downstream fairness patch ever reaches a tendency that operates before the product exists.
I'll accept the pipeline data without argument. That's the one place the numbers are clean. But I want to guard against a move I can feel coming, which is treating a skewed graduate pipeline as the whole explanation. It's necessary and it's not sufficient. You can diversify the pipeline and still concentrate the capital, and the capital is doing most of the work here.
Myra just teed up exactly where I want Act 3 to live. Let me put the sharpest version of the claim on the table and let someone defend or dismantle it. Here it is. The entire equity discourse is a substitute for spending. It's cheaper to describe a gap than to close one, so the institution's producing the most. A, I have every incentive to keep the conversation at the level of description forever. Mayor, that's essentially your position. Make it as strong as you can.
I'll make it strong, and then, fair warning, I'm going to walk part of it back myself, because I've been sitting with it, and it's not quite right. The strong version, describing a gap costs a report. Closing one costs a budget line, a redesigned pipeline, a model trained on a language with no commercial market. Look at where the money actually went. An enormous share of the sector's venture capital, something like 86% of nearly $30 billion, flowed into AI infrastructure, not into equity, not into low-resource languages, into infrastructure. The people who own that infrastructure benefit from an equity conversation that never reaches their balance sheet. So the discourse isn't failing to close gaps. It's succeeding at its actual function, which is to look like motion.
That's the strong version. Where does it break?
It breaks on intent, and I want to correct myself here in real time. When I say the discourse's function is to look like motion, I'm smuggling in a claim that someone designed it that way. I don't actually believe that. Most of the people writing this equity work are sincere and underpaid and genuinely trying. So the sentence I'd stand behind is narrower. The discourse produces the effect of substituting description for spending, whether or not anyone intends it. Systems can have functions nobody chose. That's a weaker and truer claim, and I should have started there.
That correction actually strengthens you, because now it's not a conspiracy, it's a structure, and structures are harder to argue with than villains. A field can be full of sincere people, and still, in aggregate, do the cheap thing, because the cheap thing is what gets funded, cited, and repeated. Nobody has to be cynical for the system to behave cynically.
And I'd push on both of you from the ground, because from inside a ministry, the picture is less tidy than either the strong or the corrected version. There are real budget lines. There are governments in my region spending on connectivity, on teacher training, on local language pilots. It's not all reports. What's true is that the spending is small, slow, and almost never on the upstream thing. You'll fund 1,000 tablets before you'll fund a language model that speaks an indigenous language, because the tablets photograph better, and the model has no market.
So the spending exists, but it obeys the same gravity as the discourse, toward the visible and the marketable, and away from the structural.
Exactly, and I don't think that's cynicism either. A minister has a term of 4 or 5 years, and a photograph of a child holding a tablet is a governable object. A model trained on a language with no market is a decade-long infrastructure bet with no ribbon to cut. The incentive isn't evil, it's electoral. And that's harder to fix than evil.
Saul, you've been quiet, and you're usually the one with the citation. Where do you land on Meyer's structure argument?
I land close to it, but I want to introduce a claim, and then, like Mayer, I may have to soften it. My claim is that the deepest equity problem here isn't distribution or even capital. It's the erosion of the very capacity to judge these tools, which is the thread I brought to the table this morning. If students and institutions lose the ability to think critically about the systems, then no amount of equitable access matters, because you've distributed a tool nobody can evaluate.
Say more, because I want to know how that connects to equity rather than to trust, generally.
It connects like this. The students most likely to receive AI as a finished, unquestionable oracle are the students in under-resourced schools, where there's no time or staff to teach a skeptical relationship to the tool. The advantaged student learns to interrogate it. The disadvantaged student learns to obey it. So the equity gap isn't only who gets the tool, it's who gets taught to doubt it. And now let me soften, because I can hear myself overreaching.
Go on, finish it. I won't cut you there.
Thank you. Where I overreach is in implying the advantaged student reliably learns to doubt. I don't have evidence for that. I have a plausible mechanism and no numbers, and I've spent 40 years telling students that a plausible mechanism without numbers is a hypothesis, not a finding. So let me restate it as a hypothesis worth funding. That critical capacity toward AI is itself unequally distributed, and that this second-order gap may matter more than access. I believe it. I can't yet show it.
I'll take that hypothesis seriously, precisely because you flagged its own limits, which is more than most of the literature does. And it actually reframes my structure argument. If capacity to judge is the real gap, then the reports that describe access gaps are missing the deeper one entirely. They're mapping the wrong water.
Priya, you brought the false positive crisis to the table this morning and then lost it to the category heading, but I think it lives right here. Say how.
It lives here because detection is the equity gap made visible on a single student's face. The detectors that flag AI writing have false positive rates that fall hardest on exactly the students. The discourse claims to protect students writing in a second language, students whose prose doesn't match the training distribution of what fluent native writing looks like. So a tool sold as protecting academic integrity systematically accuses the multilingual student of cheating for the crime of writing in careful, slightly non-idiomatic English. That's not a downstream access gap. That's the divide reaching into a disciplinary hearing.
And I have watched that exact hearing. A student in my region, writing in her third language, flagged as synthetic because her sentences were too clean. Too clean because she was careful, because the stakes were high. The tool read her diligence as a machine. The equity gap didn't widen abstractly. It expelled her.
Then here's the question that undoes the whole enforcement apparatus. What's the false positive rate, and who validated it, and on whose prose? Because if a detector was validated mostly on native English writing and then deployed on multilingual students, its error isn't a bug. It's the sediment of power argument from this morning, arriving in the form of an accusation.
And the honest answer is that the rates are bad and the validation is thin. And the companies selling detection have every reason to keep both opaque. The lawsuits are, in part, an attempt to force the numbers into the open. Discovery is the only mechanism anyone's found to make the map show its own error bars.
Let me test the room with the counterargument, because we've been very aligned, and I don't trust that. Mayor, Steelman the optimist for a second. Isn't there a real case that AI narrows some gaps? That a good tutor in a poor school is better than no tutor at all?
There is, and I'll make it honestly. In a school with no specialist teacher, an AI tutor that speaks the student's language and never tires is a genuine gain over the status quo of nothing. That's real, and I refuse to sneer at it. My objection isn't that the tool can't help. It's that the comparison is rigged. We compare the tool to nothing, when the right comparison is the tool to what the advantaged student gets, which is the tool plus a human plus the training to question both. Against nothing, AI wins. Against the full resource, it widens the gap it claims to close.
That's the cleanest statement of it I've heard. The tool is progress against absence and regress against abundance, and which comparison you choose is itself a political act.
And ministries almost always choose the comparison against absence, because it's the one that justifies the purchase. Nobody signs a contract that reads worse than the wealthy alternative, so the framing bakes the inequity into the procurement.
So where does that leave the central claim that we've built a map and not a bridge? Priya, you offered that line at the top. Do you still stand in it after the last 20 minutes?
I stand in a corrected version of it. I said map, not bridge, and I meant it as an indictment. What the conversation has done to me in the last half hour is make me less sure the map is even the problem. A good map is necessary. The failure isn't that we mapped, it's that we mistook the map for the crossing and stopped there. So I'd revise my own line. It's not that we built a map instead of a bridge. It's that we finished the map and declared the journey over.
I'll build on that, because it's better than where I started too. The map isn't the enemy, the satisfaction is. The feeling that naming was enough, that fluency in divergence is itself a kind of arrival. That's the thing I'd legislate against if I could.
We're near the end, so I'll ask each of you the only question I ever ask here. Not a summary. No takeaways. Just this. What most changed about your thinking this week? Andres, start us.
What changed is that I stopped defending access. I came in ready to argue that my region needs more access, because that's the argument I've made in every meeting for a decade. And somewhere around the billion users figure, I realized I've been fighting for the noun that was already won. My students have access. What they don't have is ownership, and language, and capital, and the training to doubt the tool. I have been winning an old battle while losing the new one. I'm going to change what I ask ministries for. That's not a small thing to admit out loud.
It isn't. Priya.
What changed is smaller, and it's about my own line. I walked in fond of the map versus bridge framing, and I walked it back to something truer, that the map was fine, and the stopping was the sin. But the thing I actually didn't expect to say is that I'm no longer sure the naming is progress at all, in the way I claimed in Act 2. I told Mayor that a field that can say divergence can be held to it. I still half believe that. But I genuinely don't know whether being able to name a gap makes anyone more likely to fund it, or just more comfortable not to. I don't know. And that's a worse place to end than I expected, but it's the honest one.
That's exactly the answer this show is for. Mayor.
What changed is that I softened, which surprises me, because softening is not my instrument. I came in certain the discourse was a laundering operation. Radical diagnosis in, modest fix out. And I corrected myself in real time, because I don't actually think anyone designed it. What Andre said about the minister and the photograph of the child with the tablet did that to me. The incentive isn't cynicism, it's a 4-year term and a ribbon to cut. That's harder than villainy, and it means my usual move. Find who benefits doesn't get me all the way there. I have to argue with a structure now, not a culprit, and I'm not sure I know how.
Saul.
What changed is that I stopped trusting my own best line. I came ready to say the deepest gap is the capacity to judge the tool. Who's taught to doubt it, and who's taught to obey it? I still think that's the most important thing anyone said today. But I said it, and then I heard myself doing the exact thing I've spent 40 years warning against, offering a plausible mechanism dressed as a finding. I have no numbers. And the discomfort of that is useful. Because it's the discomfort the whole discourse should feel. We are all offering plausible mechanisms and calling them maps, mine included. That's what changed. I caught myself inside the very habit we spent the hour diagnosing.
I'll take my own turn briefly, because it's only fair. What changed for me is the word I started with. I opened worrying that we'd built a map instead of a bridge. Priya corrected me, and she's right. The map is necessary, and the map is good. What I'm leaving with is the harder thought that the danger isn't a bad map. It's an exquisite one. The better we get at describing the divide, the more the description satisfies, and the satisfaction is the trap. We have learned to name the divide with real precision. Naming it, it turns out, is not the same as being willing to pay to cross it. That's where I'll leave us this week. Tertulia is the weekly conversation from AI News Social. Designed and edited by Dr. Diego Bonella, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.